Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, when the U.S. military attacks on Syria got underway, there was a sudden shift in coverage. We weren't just bombing the Islamic State, but something called the Khorasan Group. But who are they, and how come no one's ever heard of them before? We'll talk to reporter Murtaza Hussain of The Intercept about that. Also this week, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi received a royal welcome when he arrived in the U.S. for a visit on September 26th. For a republic, it's always been a little strange how the U.S. treats foreign heads of state like royalty. But with his controversial past in politics, Modi's treatment was even more curious than most. We'll talk with Trinity College history professor Vijay Prashad about Modi's American reception. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's news.
As the U.S. military launched attacks on Iraq and Syria, corporate media were falling into some very familiar patterns. We saw the TV panels dominated by former government and military officials. On the September 28th Face the Nation, viewers heard the current Deputy National Security Advisor, a retired general, a former Pentagon official, and the former number two man at the CIA. A wide-ranging debate, in other words, from the Pentagon all the way over to the CIA. Over on ABC's This Week, Martha Raddatz brought viewers a long report from a U.S. aircraft carrier, which amounted to an infomercial cheering on the pilots' difficult tasks and the preparation of precision bombs. The show also had a wide-ranging debate, featuring interviews with a former Marine pilot and the current commander of U.S. Naval Forces. And what about the fact that innocent civilians might die from U.S. strikes? Well, that's not the kind of thing that's going to get a lot of attention in a media system that is more often likely to sound like this. September 24th dispatch from CBS reporter Bob Orr.
Now, the U.S. airstrikes did considerable damage. Pentagon officials said, in fact, the bombs and missiles hit every intended target.
And Fox News analyst Ralph Peters is not afraid to talk about innocent civilians killed by the U.S. Indeed, Peters seems to argue that war, done right, pretty much requires killing innocents. Here he is on Hannity's September 23rd broadcast.
And by the way, another thing we got to get over, this nonsense about there can't be any civilian casualties. War is ugly, sloppy, and messy, and sometimes there are civilian casualties, especially when your enemy uses human shields. If you're going to go after ISIS, you got to suck it up and do what's right.
A week later, Peters complained to Hannity that the military's hands were tied by political correctness, which resulted in useless pinprick popgun airstrikes. Peters shared insights from his sources.
My contacts within the chain of command, people involved in this operation, are furious that Obama has put incredible targeting restrictions on them. Doesn't want any civilian casualties. This is war, dude. Right. Civilians die. They're going to die. You minimize the casualties, but people are going to die.
Peters might have known that Yahoo's Michael Isikoff was reporting that White House policies to protect civilians from drone strikes will not be enforced in Syria and Iraq. One might assume that for Peters, even this standard is too easy on Syria's civilians.
Of course, the rantings of a Fox News pundit are, well, the rantings of a Fox News pundit. That's right-wing media for you. But don't think for a second that the mainstream media doesn't offer similarly bizarre analysis. CBS Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer has been a very vocal supporter of this new war. Obama had no choice, as he's put it, which could explain why no one who might disagree with that assessment has appeared on his show. And on the September 28th broadcast, he explained his idea about how the war on terrorism works.
Reality is not always to our liking, but it is reality. The president's decision to go after ISIS was a recognition that the war on terror is not over and won't be over until the terrorists say it's over, which they will never do, and which is why they must be destroyed.
So the war won't be over until the terrorists cry uncle, which they won't. So we must kill all of them. Since this is basically impossible, we can only conclude that Schieffer is saying he supports a war that won't ever end.
In the October issue of Harper's Magazine, Eugenia Williamson looks at the history of PBS, with a particular focus on how far the system has strayed from its intended mission. What was supposed to be a forum for the underrepresented has long been just another outlet for elite establishment-oriented views. As Williamson writes, quote, today the only special interest group the network clearly favors is the aging upper class. Their tastes, their pet agendas, their centrist politics, close quote. The Harper's headline alone, PBS self-destructs and what it means for viewers like you, was guaranteed to rankle the people at PBS, and it did. PBS reportedly distributed talking points to station managers that, rather than refute Harper's claims, amount to little more than lists of awards and ratings data to show that PBS is actually doing a great job. But that wasn't PBS's only reaction. As the New York Post reported, PBS is planning to pull ads from the next two issues of Harper's. This is some kind of irony. PBS was set up on the principle that advertising exerts undue pressure on media outlets, so that PBS would be one outlet free from such pressure. If PBS was looking for a single gesture to confirm Harper's charges, they may have found it.
And finally, journalists aren't supposed to take positions, of course, but they do that kind of thing all the time. Sometimes it's clear just from a headline, like this one from the September 28th New York Times. Long shots loom as spoilers in tight November races across nation. The story is about political candidates who have the nerve to not be affiliated with the two major parties. The fact that they are attracting some support from voters makes them spoilers. Which, of course, insinuates that a political system with just two parties is one that works just fine, thank you very much. One has to wonder what reporters would call the voters who are supporting these candidates. Are they spoiling things, too? Or look at the Washington Post the next day on September 29th. A full-page story boasted this headline, "Social Security is a mess." This has been an article of faith among too many reporters for decades now. The system is on the brink of collapse, and it needs immediate reform, by which they usually mean raising taxes on workers and cutting benefits. The Post piece isn't exactly calling for anything like that, necessarily. It lays out the options for fixing the program, and it invites readers to come up with the right formula. But why start from the premise that the program is a mess? Social Security is a wildly popular and wildly successful government program. It requires some adjustments to continue to be a vital source of security for many millions who would be in serious trouble without it. But a story that presented Social Security that way, headlined maybe "Social Security Works" or something like that, well, good luck getting an editor to accept that premise.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
The timeline of events that led up to U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria is pretty clear. Islamic State fighters released menacing, disturbing videos that included the beheadings of U.S. reporters. Politicians in this country warned that ISIS could strike the homeland. Public opinion then shifted quickly in favor of bombing. But then when the U.S. attacks actually began, especially in Syria, some of the main targets were not ISIS, but something called the Khorasan Group, former al-Qaeda operatives who we were told were far more dangerous than the people we were supposedly going after in the first place. Joining us now is Murtaza Hussein. He's a reporter for The Intercept. He traced the media hype around Khorasan in a piece co-written with Glenn Greenwald, the fake terror threat used to justify bombing Syria. Murtaza, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there was this enemy we knew, and then as the bombs began falling, there was, as the NBC graphic put it, the new enemy. Your piece says there are serious questions about whether the Khorasan group even exists in any meaningful or identifiable manner. And the piece adds, this is the wholesale concoction of a new terror threat. It seems like this was, to put it crudely, the White House rebranding a group that did exist, but did not have perhaps a scary-sounding name. Is that it?
Right. So it's not that people weren't targeted in Syria and they weren't militants, but this idea of a Khorasan group, which exists and which is an entity which people can identify, is something that was manufactured by the administration. So essentially, the people who were hit were members of a group called Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one of the opposition factions fighting the Syrian government. It also happens to at least nominally be affiliate of al-Qaeda under the control of Ayman al-Zawahiri. The complication is that the al-Nusra Front is very popular within Syria today, because not because of the ideology so much, but because of the fact it's one of the most effective groups fighting against the Syrian government. And it's also an enemy of the Islamic State, which is also hitting these strikes. So it seems the U.S. did not want to say they were bombing Jabhat al-Nusra, so they developed this label of the Khorasan group, which simply identified those members of the Jabhat al-Nusra whom they wanted to hit. So it was a bit of ideological fabrication, in the sense that there is no group called the Khorasan group, and they did not want to say who they actually were targeting in this case.
And Khorasan has some actual meaning, correct?
Well, Khorasan, it's a couple of meanings. First, it's a province which is historically in Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan. And also there are religious connotations to the word Khorasan, because a lot of militant groups take this hadith from Islamic history that talks about the black banners of Khorasan, which will come out of that region and liberate certain areas within the region from oppression. So a lot of militant groups claim to be acting, that's their inspiration, that's hadith, or they claim that they are the descendants of the, well, who are being referred to in the hadith. So there are like mythic or religious connotations to where that name comes from as well.
From a propaganda perspective, there's something kind of fascinating here. The reports that you cite have the appearance, in a way, of journalism that is digging deeper. Here's the real story about what's happening, which serves to mask the stenographic nature of the reporting, which was essentially, here's what Pentagon officials and White House officials are telling us about the real target of their airstrikes.
Right. There's really a lack of skepticism with regard to government claims, in a sense. So the reporting was framed as though, well, we've discovered this secret information thanks to the government, who revealed to us that there's a real threat and this is what it is. Where, you know, there was not that necessary skepticism that says, well, what is the government trying to get out of leaking this story? And not only was there not a skepticism, but the story was picked up very enthusiastically. And in the days leading up to the strike, it built up, you know, a crescendo of hyperbole and fear regarding this group. And then immediately after the strikes, you know, people started to parse this information a bit more and see that there was something very confusing about this narrative. It didn't seem to correspond to any narrative which made sense to people who watched Syria or people who were within Syria. And then in the days after, officials started to say, well, you know, there was not an imminent threat. We don't know who these people were hit, in the sense that we don't know if there actually was a Khorasan group. We don't think that they'll identify themselves that way. And then finally, they said that, you know, any plot that we talked about was, in fact, not as imminent as we meant. It was aspirational. So the entire threat, which had been used to justify the strikes, which, you know, were done under emergency circumstances and were not subject to congressional authorization, that whole narrative sort of disappeared. But then, you know, what happened leading up to that then?
You know, there's a school of thought that says, why invent or rebrand a group to make them into supervillains? The public had already been whipped up into a panic over ISIS. So from a propaganda standpoint, it hardly seemed necessary to introduce this new menace or this new threat. Whose interests are served by this Khorasan story? Does it give the Obama administration another way to talk about fighting al-Qaeda without using the term al-Qaeda?
I think that's part of it. So, you know, if the U.S. is saying that there's an imminent threat from al-Qaeda and, you know, they exist in vast numbers, it leads to other questions of, well, if that's the case, what's been happening the last 13 years and how has our strategy to fight this group backfired so badly that, you know, they're more numerous than ever and they're able to menace us in ways which, you know, necessitate these extreme policies? By inventing the Khorasan group, it can accomplish many goals. First, it defers these questions and deflects them to, you know, another new group which has arisen, which is not actually true. And then secondly, it allows the U.S. to dissociate itself from being seen as attacking the enemies of Bashar Assad, whom they also have committed themselves to being an enemy of, by saying, well, we're not attacking Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one of the most potent forces against him. We're attacking the Khorasan group, which is a group which focuses on us. But again, to anyone in Syria, that this it sounds ridiculous, because they all know that this is Jabhat al-Nusra and they know that what these strikes have accomplished. So I think that just the the feeling that they had to create a new narrative to justify what they're doing leads to many questions of what is trying to be concealed and what's being gained from this.
You mentioned feelings inside Syria, and I've seen some reports, and there have even been some television reports from Syrian fighters on the ground who are actually disappointed by the U.S. strikes because they do see this as an attack on a group that is fundamentally capable of defeating Assad, or at least posing a real threat to the Assad regime, and now they see the United States taking that group out.
Exactly, and that's why the other narrative, which is that, you know, these strikes will be a humanitarian benefit to Syrian people, it really does not ring true for most Syrians, because, you know, as bad as ISIS and other groups have been, and as bad as Jabhat al-Nusra is in a certain way as well, they really pale in comparison to the state violence which has been inflicted by the Syrian government on most people. And now they see the U.S. finally intervening after all these years, and they're intervening on the side, well, seemingly at least, on the side of the Assad against the opposition. So for that reason, people are quite aggrieved about the attacks in Jabhat al-Nusra. And when the U.S. decided to designate them a terrorist group in the first place, people were very aggrieved because, well, you know, whatever ideology they may hold, they're the most robust defense we have against the state in this case. So I think people, Syrians, are understandably not enthusiastic about these strikes. And I think this might have the perverse effect of uniting Jabhat al-Nusra with ISIS. Those two groups have heretofore been quite staunch enemies, and it may actually accomplish the opposite of dividing and conquering your enemies. It may end up uniting them all in one front.
We've been speaking with Murtaza Hussain. He's a reporter for The Intercept. His piece, "The Fake Terror Threat Used to Justify Bombing Syria," co-written with Glenn Greenwald, can be found at their website. Thanks for joining us this week, Murtaza Hussain.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi arrived in the U.S. on September 26 to what seemed like a royal welcome. The trip was topped off by a large gathering at Madison Square Garden. With us to talk about Modi's visit and his media reception is Vijay Prashad, a professor of history at Trinity College in Connecticut and the author of The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. His column in The Guardian, "Tough Guy Modi is the Man of the Moment for Wealthy Indian Americans," can be read online at The Guardian. Welcome back to Counterspin, Vijay Prashad.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
For a republic, it's strange how the U.S. often treats foreign heads of state like royalty, but Modi's past and his politics make the practice extra interesting, don't they?
Well, yes, that's true. Modi is an interesting character. He was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat, which has, to his credit, has been a shining beacon of neoliberal growth. In other words, he has been able to, in that state, erase labor rights substantially. He's been able to get rid of environmental protections and therefore been able to attract the kind of business that seems to get, a lot of kudos in the world. So Mr. Modi has that reputation. He also has a reputation of having had his hand on the tiller during a rather bloody pogrom against Gujarat's Muslims in 2002, which was sparked off by the burning of a train where some Hindu pilgrims had died. So, you know, this is his record. It was the second, event, the pogrom, for which he had been actually denied a U.S. visa for 10 years. So this is his first visit after his visa, a situation had changed.
So was it just that he had been elected prime minister, or were there any other changes, any contrition?
No, there's been no contrition. You know, it's important to actually say that the United States has pegged a great deal in terms of its strategic understanding of Asia to this new relationship with India. So during the Bush administration, there was a very close relationship with the Indian government, and a U.S.-India strategic partnership was begun, including a 10-year defense agreement. Well, it was very important for the United States government to welcome Mr. Modi because that 10-year defense agreement was up for renewal. And indeed, that was one of the main items of business that Mr. Modi and Mr. Obama conducted. They renewed the 10-year defense agreement. So principally, the shift was that Mr. Modi is now the head of the Indian Republic, and therefore, as the head of India, had to be invited and welcomed in order for this geostrategic understanding to be continued.
Well, I want to get back just for a second in the state where he was head, and you mentioned he turned it into a sort of a model of neoliberal politics. This is a bit of a softball, but how did workers and the poor fare?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, Steve, in this day and age when joblessness is the kind of way we generally describe most of the world. 90% of India's workers are in the informal sector. So it's very hard to actually measure the gains made by workers. These are mainly migrant workers who come into the state of Gujarat. They work in very difficult conditions. They are far from home, therefore they are insecure. They don't have roots in Gujarat. They've been unable to produce unions. So, you know, they might turn around and say, well, at least we have a job. The conditions of work are abysmal. And Gujarat has, I think, the most industrially dirty place called Vapi, where all environmental regulations have been cut. There's also been a number of reports of extensive use of child labor in some of the most lucrative of Gujarat's industries, for instance, in diamond polishing, you know, which is a very big part of Gujarat's, growth structure. So it's a mixed bag in terms of the fact that it has been able to employ a large number of people, but the conditions of employment are truly abysmal. And, you know, it's helped along by the fact that the model that it's picked is actually the model that the international finance institutions are looking forward to exporting around the world. So there's very little criticism of Mr. Modi's growth model for Gujarat. And just one thing about that is that I interviewed a number of Indian businessmen who were there in New York for Mr. Modi's celebration. And they were very clear that what they were celebrating was the kind of, welcome to business sign that Mr. Modi has placed over the gates to India.
So that's really his appeal. It's the neoliberal politics, the business, the corporate-friendly politics. It's not his 56-inch chest.
Well, the 56-inch chest helps because, you know, it's interesting. Perhaps the best parallel for Mr. Modi is Mr. Erdogan of Turkey. In other words, both of them have a kind of populist demeanor where they try to appeal to masses of people, saying that they and their personality are capable of solving intractable problems. And so that's the way they are able to garner enough people to vote for them. It's important to say that only 30% of the Indian voting public, people that cast their ballots, Mr. Modi won only 30% of the votes for this election. So it's not like he's coming into power with a majority behind him. Nonetheless, they've been able to convert that 30% of vote into a kind of, a wave of appreciation for him. This is great PR work. It's super work. But the thing about that 56-inch chest is it's not trivial, because this understanding of contemporary populism is that the personality can really change things. And, you know, this is dangerous because it means that they go around national laws and they go around the institutions of a democracy. So, you know, neoliberalism likes these 56-inch personalities. Neoliberalism is not keen on the slow pace of democratic decision-making.
Yes, yes. Well, I want to talk about the media, especially the media here in the United States and the coverage of his trip. Modi's big talk at Madison Square Garden was co-hosted, oddly, by PBS News anchor Hari Srinivasan. This would seem weird for a weird choice for a prominent journalist to make. What have you seen in general in U.S. media coverage?
again, there is a little bit, spice of a suggestion that the question of human rights should be raised with Mr. Modi. You know, that occasionally comes on the radar. The most astounding thing is that during the Madison Square Garden event, there was a protest, and that was essentially blacked out. Many people who were protesting, had talked to the media, and when the media discovered they had adverse feelings towards Mr. Modi, they were basically cut out of the story. So there's a lot of that happened, but, you know, in a sense, that's understandable. We're dealing with a very, very sophisticated media juggernaut that was able to disguise the fact that the principal organizers of this event in New York City were on the one side big business and on the other side, you know, members of the very far right who have played a prominent role in U.S. society. And, you know, so it's people who were the overseas friends of the BJP. It's people who were part of the U.S. establishment of the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the kind of, you know, the fascist element of the Hindu right. So there was a kind of papering over basic journalistic work of asking who's organizing this event, who's paying the bills, you know, didn't seem to be done. What was basically looked at is lots of people are coming to see Modi, therefore he must be a rock star. The question that should have been asked is who is pushing this, who is running it, and who is making sure the message is very tightly controlled.
We've been speaking with Vijay Prashad of Trinity College in Connecticut. You can read his column about Modi. Tough Guy Modi is the man of the moment for wealthy Indian Americans online at The Guardian. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Vijay Prashad.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group, Fair. If you like Counterspin, then please check out Extra, Fair's monthly magazine. Go to fair.org to find out how to subscribe. Also, that's where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the Counterspin podcast, or watch Fair TV. This show was engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.